I will give a de Culbertson, who happens to be the founder of the modern Olympics in 1896, and then we will have a brief discussion on, from an American studies point of view, on the history of it, or the glories of it, or the ritual, or whatever. I'll give a few pros in the sense of the mild purpose of the Olympics, and then we'll get to the issues with some of the problems of the Olympics. According to Baron de Culbertson in 1896, the most important thing in the Olympic Games is not to win, but to take part. Just as the most important thing in life is not the triumph, but the struggle. The essential thing is not to have conquered, but to have fought well.
That's it?
That's it.
All right. I was hoping you'd do a little bit more so I could think about this. Because this is done in the great holding tradition of how many of you buyers and will win it. And some of you have been into the forums, and I firmly believe in that thing. Last year, I'm stalling, obviously. Last year, a friend of mine and I did one of these things. He came with three pages, you know, single space type with notes, and I had a couple, you know, I had a couple of things scribbled out, and we about, you know, about equal distance. We made it back and forth. Anyway, a little bit of background. Why is it, you know, why are they so appealing? And I think they furnish certain kinds of, you know, psychological needs, which have the advantage, obviously, of continuity and, you know, with tradition. I would like to say just very briefly, though, that I think there are two sort of basic appeals in the sense that they furnish both the sense of ritual and pageantry and spectacle, which we all enjoy. This is the one thing I won't be able to see because we get home the day they end. And I'm not, I'm sure Amtrak doesn't have, you know, a television set. But anyway, I'm sure they'll be on VCRs and the rest of them. But spectacle and ritual, and I think ritual is very important because we know ahead of time what's going to happen in ritual. And that furnishes, I think, a certain kind of need for us that we like. We want to participate in it because we know it's going to make us feel good. And it's like, you know, like I'm going to a wedding, you know, that same sort of thing. I mean, people know it's going to be a happy occasion. They don't expect any real innovation, although they might have some innovation in the music or the decor or something else like that. But basically, you know what's ahead of time and you look forward to it and you enjoy it simply for its own sake because of the, you know, the fixedness of the whole thing. And therefore, I think we know there are going to be the different kinds of competition. With the track and the field events, the bicycling, the kayaks, all the different things. And that furnishes us with a sort of a sense of continuity. These things have always gone on, and yet once in a while they add new events. So the luge was what, 1972 or 70? No, it was recent anyway in the Winter Olympics.
48
was that it? Okay, we never even heard of it. But nevertheless, there's always some little wrinkle that comes in, and then some other things which go out. On the other hand, besides the sort of the continuity and sort of the knownness, or the, how should I say this, the sense that we know what's going to happen and look forward to that because it's going to make us feel good with all the sort of the glorification of the international business. And I think all of this has been enhanced by Chariots of Fire. Because we look back at those funny men in their long pants or their long shorts, you remember, and running around and everything else. And yet we like the fact that we understood the continuity. But one benefit, I think, that Chariots of Fire had for us was the fact that we knew the continuity and we could link with it, and yet there were always some surprises. We weren't quite sure yet if the good guys were going to win or, you know, if they were going to lose. It's pretty obvious after they'd given us the treatment with the two British subjects that they were going to win, and yet we, of course, if we looked at the records, we could have found out that they had been, you know, beaten Jackson Schultz, wasn't that his name, who does commercials now for American Express. Even though, what is he, 87 years old? On the other hand, it has the advantage, obviously, of competition, the unknown. I think that's the advantage with a spectacle like the Olympics, is of the unknown. And there is a theory there about competition, in that why are we, you know, attracted day in and day out, year in, decade and century out to competition, in that our own lives are pretty, you know, ambiguous in the sense that we know there's a struggle, we know there are battles, tussles and things going on, but most of the time, we don't really resolve these conflicts or issues, you know, within our own lives. Pretty much it's a matter of, you know, something will change, something will come around tomorrow, and keep whatever battle it is with our boss or our children or whatever it is sort of alive, and we won't have that sort of sense of completeness or finality. But you go to a ball game or you go to a competition like this, and there's, you know, it's final. there is a completeness with it, and it's a struggle, you know, between those we choose to, you know, to support and those we have made up in our own minds as adversaries or foes or enemies, whatever it might be. And you add to that, you know, all the glamour of, you know, the flags and the, you know, the ritual, the pageantry, the interesting costumes and all that go along with it. I think that's good. Furthermore, in our society, I think with a competition, we need heroes. We always need heroes in one way or another, and already, is his name Carl Lewis? Is that the one? He's already larger than life. I mean, he hasn't even competed, or Mary Decker, if you like. They're already larger than life, even though she lost. And then suddenly we have a new hero. Wysecki, is that her name? The one who defeated her in the 1500?
Yes.
And she took off 12 seconds off her earlier time. It's incredible. You take 12 seconds off on a 1500, and all of a sudden she becomes a new hero. And we need those, and we follow them. What is it with Lewis? He's got thousands, not thousands, but hundreds of people following him around LA, just chanting his name. Already, and you know, once you get on the cover of Time or Newsweek, you know, that's you become immortalized. We need heroes, and they furnish us with the spectacle and the drama that we seem to need. Furthermore, with the Olympics, it's a glorification of youth, which is an ongoing theme which many of us want to hold on to as, you know, as long as possible, in one way or another. It's the idea that maybe someday they will be, you know, in the stands, or they'll be doing the color commentary for television, or whatever it might be, like fellow Marty Lacquerie. That's what I'm trying to think of. The Meyer from Villanova, wasn't he? I think, yeah. And or Mark Spitz does, you know, on swimming and so on. But right now it's youth, and right now youth are, you know, really very important. And competition then furnishes us with answers. We go there knowing there'll be, you know, a final conclusion to it all, and we leave, you know, either elated over the outcome or else, you know, wait till next year. And I think the Olympics have had the reputation, just speaking in very general terms here, of having this, the only word for it is, you know, in excelsis. Nothing else quite matches it, and there has been the hope, at least until we get to, you know, the problems that we'll be talking about here, that once more maybe we can get in one more great Olympics. At least that's the expectations I bring to it. Maybe one more before it all breaks up. Maybe both sides, maybe the both the Russians and us will decide in 88 that we're not going to go right now. But maybe we can get this good one also.
I think the big issue is the whole question of the reality of the Olympics and what sport is. And I think one of the things to think about is the characteristics of modern sport that has transpired in the last years, and it affects the Olympics, which can be both pros and cons. Most of this is Gutmann, who is a sociologist, idea of what sport is. And I think by thinking about the characteristics of modern sport, it takes you into the pros and the cons. He suggests, and I would agree, that sport is either sacred or secular, and that both of these, in Dorsted's discussion of it, glorifies what is. The sacredness of the old Olympics, the sacredness, almost a religion. Novak, the theologist, says the joy of sport is a religion. And when you look at the religious convictions of our society, you may find sport as really a religion. And if it is a religion, the Olympics has to be the pinnacle of the religious experience, and that's some of the value in it. That we have something beyond ourselves is a pro kind of thought process. The secularness of it makes it also possible to have it a nationalistic. And you substitute a religion of one kind or another within the Olympic scene. The second one is the equality that transpires within a nation, that theoretically any boy, and now perhaps girl, can develop in a particular sport. That we have educational sports, the track and field, any kid in the world can be a part of. Boxing, any kid in the world can be a part of. And in our own nation, we have really used sport in a sense of developing equality. And it shows up more, perhaps, in the Olympics than in almost any other territory except basketball, particularly as we deal with the blacks. And the meaning of that, I think, will probably be dealt with. But equality is one of the things that brings us to sport. We also are all interested in equipment, that the equipment is equal. You know, in the 72 Olympics was a problem with the pole vault pole that only affluent society had the pole vault poles, so we had to change pole vault poles. And so there is an idea, at least, that sportsmanship and equality is occurring in the Olympics, in spite of the officials that caused trouble and the society in which the Olympics is held. Already we've had a nationalistic view of the Olympics, as I understand it from the openings. The third is the specialization that occurs. When you think about the specialization of sport, nothing reaches a higher specificity than the Olympics. And that's what sport is moving towards, which makes it possible to be the greatest in the world in one little thing, and that no one else can stand higher at that moment in the specialization sort of way, which will have its pros and cons. A rationalization occurs. That is, the rules of the sports are theoretically made so that everybody can participate on an equal basis, equal meaning within the rules that have been established, so that international rules are possible. And that's a very positive happening. It's probably the only area in anything that we deal with within all societies that we have agreed that we will run this distance, that we will use this kind of equipment, that we will follow these boundaries. Even in basketball, where there was a question in 72 of the legality, everybody followed the same rules and regulations. And that has a certain excitement about it and a unity that occurs through the rationalization of sport. Unfortunately, there is bureaucracy in all sport. And as a member of the United States Olympic Committee, I can tell you about bureaucracy in sport. I can tell you a lot of stories, anecdotal, on sport. But the bureaucracy permits the affluent of every society to take part in this nationalistic feeling. And by having a volunteer organization, it puts everybody a part of the spectacle that he's talking about for having a bureaucracy. The quantitative and the records. Most of you in your favorite sport, even within the Olympics, can give a record or give a hero that is a part of some record. The same as you can do with the Trinity of basketball, baseball, and what is that other minor sport? Football. This is the sort of thing that happens only every 4 years, and it can occur, and it has a positive. The other positives I see is a huge positive for women throughout the world in the opportunity to compete. There is a spectacle that is going on that will show field hockey, volleyball, and basketball at its best for all the world. And it will give opportunity for all kinds of girls and women to be able to participate. The swimming, the Winter Olympics have made tremendous freedom for girls and women. The 1978 Amateur Sports Act also gave grassroots opportunity for women. And in that sense, it's been a very positive move, not only in our society, but I think in at least all of Western society. And the Olympics is a very positive for seeing the grace, the beauty, the opportunity for girls. The same I would say for the blacks in our society, that they have been able to have heroes in a Jesse Owens, and that it has a fellowship and an identification that binds us together. I believe there is a binding that occurs and a fellowship and a brother sisterhood that occurs by the participants, if not by those of us who are spectators. I was in the Olympic Village in 1972 before the fatal happenings in the Olympics, and you saw a great deal of communication and unity occurring between the athletes. The athletes do in fact get a unity feeling and an understanding of another society that they have never had. Now it can also happen in the international other ways, but I think it's an important. I think the pursuit of excellence, the opportunity to push oneself to the very outer limits of their capability is a very positive for the participant and for the world-class athlete and those who aspire, that there is a certain awe-ness and beauty about that that can't be achieved sort of in any other way. And so I think it has those positives of reaching a pinnacle, working for it, and achieving it. And finally, for better or for worse, it brings financial opportunity to thousands of athletes.
Financial opportunity, the essence of amateurism. Speaking third here, some of my points that I was going to make have already been usurped, but maybe I can add to those a little bit. One of those has to do with the relationship between religion and sports, and I think that because of that connection, sports competition and something like the Olympics is so much more important to socialist countries than it is to our country or other Western countries, in the sense that they have elevated sports and sports competition to a unifying factor, much like religion is supposed to be in a society, a spiritual sort of unification. And East Germany, I think, is a special example of this. And maybe due to the fact that the militarism in East Germany is controlled to a great extent because of their domination by the Soviets. But Cuba and other third world socialist countries have been able to use sports and sport competition as a way of making themselves heard on the world scene, and also as a way of unifying their youth. You mentioned about the best rising to the top in this regard. I don't think that we can say that happens so directly in our country because of the way that sports is organized, and obviously that a lot of people don't even have the opportunity to ever have access to some of the equipment that's required for some sports. But in countries like Cuba and East Germany and the Soviet Union, all children start out with a certain kind of sports instruction, and then those that excel go on to the next level, and then at each level the cream of the crop is picked out and gets better and more technical assistance to coaching, till finally the Olympic team is truly, because of the selection process, it's supposed to be the cream of the crop. One of the things I was going to say was that most of us probably enjoy the Olympics, but I think we kind of enjoy the Olympics a lot like we enjoy the Super Bowl. You know, sort of like a holiday, or the religious or the ritual aspects are so important. I was surprised when the advertisements came out for buying tickets to the Olympic events, and it was monitored through Sears and Roebuck. And friends of mine that probably didn't know, had never read the sports section, ran down to try to get tickets for the Olympic events, you know, and in that sense, it kind of reminded me of the Super Bowl, that people who are interested in Hollywood-style, media chic, grandiose spectacles probably gravitate to and aren't interested in the Olympics, but those people who are truly interested in sports and sports competition probably find a letdown in the Olympics, and maybe not the competition that leads up to the Olympics, but the Olympics itself, because the spectacle overshadows the competition. In many cases, the best do not win their events, and this is due to the overriding influence of the media. Early mentioned Carl Lewis. You know, you can imagine what this guy is finally going to get out on the track. I'm sure his mind is going to be on what he's doing. You know, you can think of that he has to be an exceptional individual if he is going to be able to perform up to the level that's expected of him. And what happens if he doesn't perform up to the level that's expected of him? You know, whose responsibility is it for that, and who's going to take the blame for that? This has happened in many Olympics previously. I remember the Olympics a number of years ago, might have been back in the 1960, 64, around in there, when the world's fastest human at that time, Ray Norton, was supposed to sweep all of the sprints and events in the Olympics. And I don't even think he got a medal. And the reason for this was because he had been built up by the media and had this overconfidence, and his mind wasn't on what he was doing. Whereas the other athletes that don't have this pressure can concentrate on their activities. Which, two subjects I wanted to mention. One has to do with the nationalism that's involved in the Olympics. And I think that I'm surprised that neither of you mentioned this, that if you enjoy the Olympics, Erling did, said that this may be the last one, so pay some attention to it. If you really enjoy the Olympics, then maybe we ought to think about ways of amending them and changing them so that they do stay around for a little while. I wanted to say a couple things about that in a second, too. The pressure that's on the athletes, and I think that we have to think not, there's a difference, of course, in the types of events. There's a difference between the glamour events and the not-so-glamorous events. But the pressure might be there otherwise. The pressure to succeed, to win, has led into these problems of drugging. What is the effects of these drugs? Maybe Joanne can say something about this. The effects of these drugs on the body over long periods of time. I don't think there's been a lot of understanding about what that is. But it kind of reminds me of the super achievement that we require of football players. And so that they end up going through their life unable to perform in any competition to any significant degree because of the injuries that they carry with them. And because of this, the pressure to win in the competition. Now there's booklets put out for track athletes on how to beat the drug tests. And so that any athlete, you know, that's going into this is taking drugs, steroids and so on to build up their muscles. Has to know what kind of dosage to take, and when to let up on it, and so on, so that by the time the competition takes place, it won't be detected that they've been using these drugs. So that these rules that try to control this kind of activity give birth to ways of getting around this activity, too. It's interesting to note that the professionalism that's involved is another subject, I think, that influences some of the way that we think about the Olympics. It used to be, maybe this isn't the case anymore, it used to be that professionalism equaled entertainment. And so that an athlete that went into a professional went into a sport was in fact an entertainer. And so a lot of the pejorative or the negative connotations of having an entertainer in the family prevented a lot of excellent athletes from taking up professional careers. I don't think we have that understanding of it anymore. But originally, because of that, the black athletes in this country had an open door into professional athletics because it was similar to entertainment. Entertainment was one of those fields that blacks could go into, being that they were second-class citizens and not considered to be the right kinds of people to succeed in other areas of life. So it's surprising to find that a lot of our early athletes, for example, if you remember the little statues of black jockeys and things like that, almost all jockeys used to be black. I was reading that the first Kentucky Derby, 15 out of the 17 jockeys were black. What happened to them? In professional baseball, blacks played professional baseball at the beginning. Then something happened to them. They came back in about 1947, I guess, when Jackie Robinson came back in. Or Jack
called
Robinson.
Jimmy Crow.
What?
Called Jimmy Crow.
Well, what happened, of course, was as these professions became lucrative, then the competition increased and the racial barriers that existed were put up. But one of this, and to what extent does that still exist, or what kind of racism exists in the kinds of sports or events that people go into? Are there racial or ethnic events that we expect competitors to go into, and some, therefore, that don't go into those because there are no models for them? The last thing, I wanted to go back to this idea of nationalism. When I first started becoming interested in this subject a number of years ago, I was really interested in how you could denationalize the Olympics. And some obvious things came to mind, you know, like having uniforms. So that you couldn't tell which country people were from just by the uniforms they were wearing, wiping out, you know, the parade of athletes at the beginning. But you know, I thought about some more of these things too, and I think you probably already came to the same conclusion I did. If you wiped out the nationalism, there probably wouldn't be any interest in the Olympics. That's probably the reason that most people are interested in the Olympics, not because they're interested in athletic competition, pure athletic competition. So that's out, you know, as one way to preserve the Olympics. One suggestion has been to treat the Olympics like World Cup soccer is treated. And that's where you have a series over a year-long period of playoffs in various areas of the country so that finally you come down to the a final two-week competition in which the cream of the crop from around the world has gathered. That, of course, cuts way down on the expenses. And cuts down a great deal, too, on the interests, even though the eyes of the world are on it. It cuts down on some of the politics that are involved, although not to a great deal. So this decentralization of events is also a possibility. So instead of having all of the events in one area of the city at one time, that these events are scattered out throughout the world. That might be a possibility, too, for diminishing the kind of pressure and political pressure that comes to bear on the Olympics. And lastly, what I'd like to see is maybe the extension to other areas of international competition, something like gold medals for poetry. You know, that seems frivolous, but is this what we require of our athletes, that they are only good in one thing, and that's it, and that's what it means to be a great Olympic athlete? I was surprised to find out that Plato was in one of the early Olympics as a wrestler. And Nero was too, right? In fact, I guess it was the Emperor Nero that extended musicianship to the Olympics so that he'd be able to compete. But you think about this last one's kind of frivolous. You know, there are international competitions for these types of things. They're not necessarily athletic. But my major point is that if we don't make some of these amendments, the Olympics are going to collapse of their own weight. And of course, everybody's fearful about the next Olympics being in South Korea, one of the most volatile countries in the West, and the possibilities for boycotts and terrorism that could be involved there.
There is definitely a question of the 1988 Olympics or the Olympics after that, because the International Olympic Committee is making a move to prevent anyone who boycotts an Olympic will no longer be in any Olympic ever again, or within a 25-year period. But I think there are all of these kinds of thought processes dealing with the Olympics. So what we're interested in now is any sort of issue you'd like to take with us, or any solution, or any problems that seem even bigger than those that we have suggested about, or comments of anything that you know about or would be interested in discussing. It is, by the way, going to cost $200 billion for this Olympics, $1 billion that is being spent. If you'd like to think of what that might or might not do for world hunger.
Just as a little humorous aside, this actually relates to the cost of the Olympics. In this magazine called Bread and Justice, it's made in California, there's a one-page article that says, "The Poor People's Olympics, to be held in public buildings on back roads, side streets, and alleys around the world this summer. Some of the events, the dumpster dive, the aluminum can hustling, grocery carrying, the mandatory 14 job applications a week on foot marathon, senior line waiting event, mothers of hungry children event, the cheese hoist, and the powdered milk drinking contest." And it goes into all of the tongue-in-cheek, somewhat obviously sarcastic drawing out of the cost of these kinds of things and the perhaps money well spent elsewhere.
And the governmental backing, in spite of no governmental spending,
right,
of our country, not certainly the rest of the countries, but the fact is not only the $16 million that they gave to try to revamp the Olympics, but by virtue of the tax exemption charter that Congress has passed in the early 60s, means that every corporation that's running around on TV is almost getting free advertising, because all of it can be a tax write-off in which they have donated anything or any time, any kind of the 32 declared trademark companies can take that off their income tax, besides all of the broken time that our federal government is now giving to athletes, so that the federal government has passed a broken time, which means they can pay you while you go prepare for the Olympics, so that actually your tax dollars are involved in the Olympics.
The last gentleman spoke there raised a question which I wanted to ask. Aren't most of the problems that have been enumerated here associated with, pretty much directly associated with the immensity of the whole thing? And if that is a real problem, I mean, the terrorism, the finding a place to hold it, who can hold it, et cetera, and so forth. I like the idea, too. If we can have a World Series of basketball, baseball, different seasons of the year, just like we have a World Series of baseball, they call it that. We have a World Series of Little League, if they could call it that. Why couldn't these individual events be broken down to World Series of Basketball, Baseball, Track Swimming, and thereby reduce the immensity of any one event? Wouldn't that solve a lot of these problems, or is that totally unrealistic?
No, that may well be what the solution is going to be. There already are international games in every one of the sports. The difference is merely that the spectacle of it has been combined into one. Actually, millions of dollars are spent on international competition in each one of the sports that we already have. So it certainly is a possibility.
I think that's something that's going to be seriously considered.
Well, then why do we have this one grand spectacle then if we already have international competition?
Well, it's the idea of linkage with the past, continuity, tradition. The Greeks did it, you know, the Romans did it, you know, the laurel wreath, all that sort of thing. Reaffirmation of what made Western civilization great. Yeah.
It's the ideal of what the Olympic Games are supposed to be in the brotherhood of all and the equality of sport.
And every time, every so often, a genuine hero story does come along to reaffirm that. I'm trying to think of this, the miler from Kenya. He was the policeman who ran 15 miles every day before he went to work. And he came and, who was it? Ryan had already been with it. Ryan, he beat?
Yeah. Well, Jim Ryan fell.
But he became a tremendous hero, and it was a classic Olympic story. Somebody literally running in from the bush and winning the 1500 meters. And it just reaffirmed what everybody thought. Yes, we can do this. Happened to one of my colleagues that had been in Nairobi for a couple of years and had followed the whole thing as it built up, and what this meant to that country was overwhelming. And that's what I'm trying to say.
Would they be prevented under this other format we're talking about here? You're going to have a track and field World Series.
But it's sort of like New Year's Eve. You put it all together at one time. You want to have one great big blowout. You don't sort of spread New Year's Eve over a couple of months just as well.
Why not?
And you get a lot of headaches, yeah.
Isn't it the only format where the third world participates to that extent?
Yeah.
I think that's a big factor.
They have the Asian Games, which are separate, the Maccabee Games, which are separate in terms of Pan American Games. But none of that reaches the magnitude because of the whole third world and all of the working together of them. It simply is the only international happening in which everybody's using the same rules to play the same game, whether it's the game of life or whatever.
I also think that African countries have been quick in the past to jump on these boycotts because of the cost that the games involve as part of their percentage of their budgets. It's a tremendous allocation of resources for these countries that have little excess to begin with to apply it either to capital development or building up their infrastructures. And to take this money and blow it on sending athletes to the Olympics is a real value choice for them. So I think in the past that some of them said, oh boy, a good deal is a boycott this year. We can get on with it.
What's the status of the permanent site? Is there a sentiment for it?
Yeah, that was just reviewed. I was just at a pre-Olympic scientific congress, and it dealt with philosophical, historical, what's happening physiologically. I've got some good horror stories of the physiological. But one of them was this discussion and the Greek that is being sent all over the world to bring the neutral site to Greece was there discussing it. They're talking about having one site so that the cost is so prohibitive for most countries. And the site that was recommended because of the ancient Olympics was in Greece. That has pretty well been squelched, but the possibility of one in some place like Switzerland has not. So they are discussing that even on the international level for a spot, for a permanent site, which would therefore, they hope to get rid of some nationalism. Now, I'm not sure how this would affect that, but Greece is definitely now out as the permanent site. But that is one of the solutions for the cost. One of the, probably the top Olympic historian, John Lucas, has been all over the world. And he is the one that also helped. If any of you saw that 1896 Olympic film, if you lasted through the whole story, he had been dealing with that. There was also an excellent, in terms of racial issue, Jesse Owens story, if you have a chance to see that. It had a lot more to say about the political arena of our racial issues than almost anything else. But it also showed what the Nazi Olympics did. So it's not dead. The issue is still alive, but not well.
Do you see it as a
solution?
I
think anything would be better than what's happening. And I think our opening may well have been illustrative.
I'm sorry, I've been up the whole
day. Yeah, I have too, but the opening was very nationalistic, very commercialized, and the spectacle that was probably the most positive was only the torch, where Jesse Owens' granddaughter carried the torch around, and then Johnson, Rayford Johnson, lit the torch, and that was probably the most sacred, if there was. Otherwise, the Seattle paper, if any of you came from Seattle, just really racked it over the coals as the most huge spectacle. If it took, someone was saying, if one piano was good, they put 80 out there. The whole thing was just such a spectacle, and not really even athletically, ritually sound. It was just very nationalistic.
Has all the openings been that way in the recent?
Actually, the 72 Olympics was a spectacle, but it was not nationalistic. It was not German-centered. The Montreal one was not quite as German-centered. There are certainly spectacles, but what's happening is each one wants it a little more than the last one. So the pageantry is greater than, let's get these athletes out here.
They really made a point of the music, though, for example. The music in the past has been more nationalistic because it has not infiltrated into other countries, but this music is universal. They made a point of that as being less nationalistic.
On that one. Also remember that Olympics used to have all of the arts, the music, the drama, as a part of it, even up through the 1920 Olympics. Actually, the 1920 Olympics is the beginning of the modern Olympics in this whole spectacle point.
And then it was really pointed out that the goal was to raise the emotional peak and of unity and of international amity. I thought they really accomplished it.
It was American,
but the point was that the American music seems to have gone universal. You know, it has been accepted universally.
What more American music are you talking about?
Well,
they're
I was in
Greece last year, and the thing that I was in Greece and Israel last year, and they have a thing over in Europe called Eurovision. Are any of you from Eurovision? So it's really amazing. All the European countries and also so many of the Middle East countries have a competition
right.
of music, and they pour in their songs. And on the radio stations, you hear all these international songs, no American songs, because Americans don't enter in. And there actually is a universal musical scene. The American music is quite different from that. So the idea that American music is universal. Was very discounted. In fact, I didn't hear any American music on any radio stations except for Christian American music.
Well, I'm just going to look at
that's not. I don't think that's verified by my trip to Europe.
But I think the media, the television, has played such a massive.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we are told so many things that we never even dreamed about
or cared about,
and are cared about, and then suddenly you hear. I mean, it has been discounted. Somebody said do not use this particular thing. I never have used this particular thing. And then the next interviewer says, well, according to, we understand that you have used this. Well, I haven't. Well, you know, then you begin to think, I bet they really do now use that because I've heard two people tell me that they have. And suddenly the television and the announcers are promoting what they want to be able to talk about. I think, and they are more or less imposing that on the athletes.
I think that's true, that it's happened, we've seen it happen internally with our domestic sports, that the media comes to dictate when, where, and so on. And we find that the integrity of the sport is beginning to be violated. It's like having football in summer, playing the World Series late into October, playing basketball like 8 months out of the year or something like that. And pretty soon what happens, of course, is that there's overexposure, or in the case of the Olympics, it becomes too large, too much of a media event, and it collapses, and it becomes unwieldy. And I think we have to look at the media as influential in that. And I don't really know what to do about that, because I think the media has taken over a lot of other areas of our life too, and validates reality.
Maybe some, because football viewing was down 5% last year in the Monday night ABC show. That, I think, might send a message. I want to put in a plug the other hand, though, for, you know, I don't think there'll be, you know, the World Series should be played, you know, late at night in the cold. But my father could never even listen or see the World Series because he had to work every day. And television at night gave him the chance to watch the World Series, and he loved baseball. He could tell me all the batting averages of Tinkers to every chance, and Mordecai Brown, and you know, all the rest of them. And suddenly he wanted to see it, and suddenly he got the chance because they had baseball at night.
And then we got Howard Cosell, and that ruined it all.
All we needed him was running.
I learned to turn him off and turn on Hank Stram and Jack Buck on the radio.
I hear you.
Good.
You betcha.
Except out here tonight earlier. That's your problem.
Well, there's no question that since 1960, the media has been influential in all societies, and the satellite even more in what's going to happen. The boycott of 1968 would probably have had little meaning, the black boycott. Not really the real boycott, which did not occur, but rather the black power by Thomas Smith and Collis, would not have had effect at all if it had not been for the media, which then picked it up and picked up the black cause and may have led into much of the rioting and all sorts of happenings. And they play it in any direction they wanted to. Even in 36 on Eleanor Holmes drinking on the boat, the media decided the results and what ought to happen, even when there wasn't the television part of it. So the television has to be the number one in everything that has to do with sport, by the way.
Maybe there's hope, because this year with the Democratic convention, I'm sure they'll do it for the Republicans, with only 3 hours, except, you know, whether it's the nomination thing. And it used to be gavel to gavel, even on the major networks. And what they found was that the political parties were able to condense all this and fit into the 3 hours because they weren't getting the viewership. And maybe the television won't be able to, you know, if they don't have as much coverage, then they'll have to condense the you know, what they have and concentrate on the events themselves, rather than the everlasting, you know, analyses ahead of time. That's where the trouble. Or they have to make up a story where none exists, like the conflict you were telling about. Yeah.
Right. 186 hours you're going to be exposed, starting with Saturday morning until the end of it, including the Sunday after the final. So the 12th, there'll be 186 hours of it.
We'll just change the topic or just a little bit. Could you tell us about the medical horrors you were...
We have several important evidence of what happened, particularly to gymnasts, female gymnasts in East Germany, and perhaps in Russia. We don't have complete evidence of Russia. But as you know, in gymnastics, the balance and the power and the weight is best in very small girls. And that once puberty sets in, the pelvis widens, the weight increases within 25% of their original weight between that 12th year and 16th year, whatever it happens to be. But for most girls, it's someplace around 13. And that they gave the girls preventative medication that would prevent the onset of the menstrual cycle, which therefore would prevent the onset of anything else. When they finished their jobs, as it were, they then took them off that, and about six of those East German girls became grotesque in size, in shape, in action. We know that East German girls and at least two Polish girls have been taking steroids, and were a part of the gymnastic, I mean a part of the track and field, which, if you take it in particular order, it will not show up in the evidence in terms of women. For the men, they have been blood doping, completely changing the blood of the runner, although now there's some evidence that it may not have done any good. And you know the steroids that are being used, and there is a new form of dope which can hide that as they begin to dope. Our own American athletes from the Pan American, probably 12 of them, were a part of new kinds of doping and kinds of vitamins that are being used, and that they do have side effects. Cancer is being discovered in men that had been weightlifters as long as 12 years ago, now are finding cancer cells. With the females, they are finding evidence that has interfered with their secondary sex glands and that they are unable to reproduce. And these are documented. One documentation that just arrived right straight from the mouth of a Soviet Union physical educator occurred in Eugene, in which they were doing studies on children of 1 year of age to determine the muscle fibers and the spindles around the muscle fibers, which have been demonstrated in great athletes to provide the greatest potential for what might be called natural ability. That 1 in 100 of the one-year-olds had this. They then will take that child and put them into the sport that they wish to put them in. The last part was not a part of his presentation. His presentation was merely the predictability of muscle fibers and spindles for determining potential. East Germany leaders were to also provide some new evidence of the 4 to 7 year old female on how they were determining track and field, swimming, and gymnastics. East Germany did not come to the pre-Olympic conference because their leaders decided against it. The only Russians that were there were 3 Russians, and it was some very new and what they considered exciting happenings. One was this fiber. All the Polish women were sent because they're having trouble getting Polish girls to compete. It is not within the culture. And they were all sent to the sociology to figure out how to almost force athleticism within the females. There were also some biomechanics kinds of studies on what was happening to the male athlete. The distant runners, they're doing all kinds of studies on the distant runners and the results. One new for the female, unfortunately, is, as many of you may or may not know, highly trained female athletes do not have a menstrual cycle often for 6 to 12 months. And we have considered that as normal, within the normal range. It does not interfere with child birth. It does not, hasn't interfered with reproduction. What they are now finding, however, on women from the 60s that they have found that has osteoporosity, may been affected. The percentage of it within the research is demonstrating a higher chance of that in these female athletes. And they have just reproduced that study at the University of Washington. And I'm sure it will be in time when they have catch up on the Olympics. But it's the most serious negative that has occurred in relation to women. Everything else has been really a positive. Once we discovered that iron deficiency is a natural result and have given iron supplements very carefully, there have been no difficulties with that. And as I was telling this afternoon, normal kinds of activities we're finding terribly important for the child from 0 to 12, the girl, in terms of bone marrow. But this is the first negative done by both an American and an English in separate studies that are trying to deal with that.
Elma? You said, what went wrong?
That the female, during the puberty and into the menstrual cycle, the bone marrow has been interfered in the bone density by virtue of not having the hormones which produce those. And so the lack of the estrogen working in the female has really deteriorated. And now they're finding the osteoporosis and high percentage of those girls. Of course, they didn't know. It's even hard to find the female athlete who has said that that is true. It's only in recent years that they have said this is true, and then are finding and being able to do studies that demonstrate the kinds
so
of
all
happenings.
Female athletes, have you trained female athletes?
Not all. It seems to be swimmers, track and field, and weightlifters.
I've read lots about women that run distance. Marathon trainers
right.
or 1,500 meters is like they have trouble, much trouble with a regular menstrual cycle. They don't have one.
Right.
Okay, so but it occurs in more often than just those types.
Right, and all highly trained athletes who are using running.
What do you think about women running longer distances?
Well, I have difficulty. In terms of endurance, it's fine. With the new evidence, I'm concerned about it. But I'm also concerned about women runners because we are finding back problems, pelvis problems, hip joint problems, knee problems, and ankle problems. For the female who was not a distant runner from their youth to 12 years old, which is where the males have gotten the bone density, the muscle mass that helps the bone marrow. So I'm concerned about the present day ones. I'm not sure that I'm concerned about those coming up because they will have had vigorous activity.
So are you in favor of the middle distances being put into the Olympics?
Oh yeah, yeah, 1500, yeah. Because we are finding no physiological limitations on the female. The distant runners, but for the normal jogger, is the one that bothers me. Actually, the only reason those distances were cut out, they were cut out of the 1928 Olympics, the first time women were in track and field, because they had the 800 meter. They had both the semifinals and the finals on the same day. 11 runners, 5 fainted before they finished, 5 finished and fainted, 1 got sick later, which happens to men later. But the press said, we told you so, and that was the end until 1960. And we have no physiological. In fact, the endurance ones are the things that women can do best with the heart-lung capacities and good fat to contribute. But I'm really concerned about this new evidence. But it's going to have some more. We have 2 minutes for big problems.
I just want to make one comment on these hormonal effects. The irony is they're trying to postpone puberty in some cases. And also the fact that no menstrual cycle means that you're bringing on premature menopause, because that's what happens in postmenopausal women,
right.
Osteoporosis, loss of calcium in the bones. So eventually we'll get those two together and there won't be any progress.
Yeah, right. It is really scary. Any other one with a last comment? Oh, yes. Tomorrow at 5:30, we're going to have a fly catching contest. I'll tell you a little more about it tomorrow. That'll be our first mini Olympic contest. I haven't decided.